Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Philip Cook from the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Philip and I met in March 2010 at the Royal Economic Society's annual conference at the University of Surrey, where he was speaking at a session on the economics of criminal behaviour. I began by asking him to explain the context for his research on crime.
I think the context is that the U.S. is currently incarcerating 2.4 million people, about 1% of the adult population. It is seven times higher than it was in the early 1970s. There's just been an absurd epidemic of using prison as being the sole answer to crime. And I think, finally, there is a real interest in reversing that process and adopting a more sensible and economical approach. That's where I came in with, I organized a conference of economists and also made a contribution myself, where the goal was to say, how can we control crime, to fight crime without the use of prison? What are the options and which of them looks the most beneficial from society's point of view?
So you want to lay out what those different options are? I mean, perhaps include the prisons one as the kind of default solution that society is using at the moment, and then the other options that there might be.
Yeah, I think that there's two basic approaches. One is that we can reduce the prison population by simply being smarter about the use of the criminal justice system. What we know more than anything else in criminology is that criminals can be deterred most effectively by a high probability of punishment. The severity doesn't matter that much. And so if we can change our sentencing policy so that we reduce the sentence lengths, which are very long in the United States, and use some of those resources to beef up the police and the courts, the result could be less crime with the same amount of money within the criminal justice system. The other general approach is social policy. It's saying how can we use social services and mental health services, certainly education, alcohol control policy, and all of the rest, to not only accomplish its main purpose, whatever that may be, but also to think about how we can use it to reduce crime rates. And so a lot of ideas came out of the conference for those approaches. My own personal contribution was a bit different. I'm interested in the question about the private contribution to crime control. So it's not so much about more government programs, more government expenditures, but it really is a question about how can we better use the private interests in avoiding crime and preventing crime to the public advantage. And that's what I've been looking at. And I think found some very interesting results about the possibilities there.
Well, perhaps you could explain the kind of private approaches to finding crime, private security kind of approaches.
One approach often is called target hardening, to make it more difficult for the criminal to break in or to steal some property. It is everything from locks and dogs to just being careful about where you walk at night and who you drink with and all the rest of it. So it's a collection of activities that we all engage in if we live in neighborhoods that are a bit dicey. That has some promise. Certainly it's been very important in the area of auto theft, for example, that what we've seen over the last few decades has been ever more sophisticated locking devices for cars that have made life more difficult for auto thieves. And as a result, for example, we have seen the end of joyriding. You know, when I was a kid, teenagers would go out and steal a car and go for a ride and leave it 5 miles down the road. That just doesn't happen anymore. It is much too hard to steal a car that is parked there without the keys in the ignition. So the result is, in the U.S., over the last 20 years, the number of cars stolen has gone down, even though the number of cars on the road has gone up by a factor of two. That really does seem to be just these sophisticated locking devices and people's investment in that kind of thing. We've seen that in other areas. What always impresses me the most is probably the credit card companies and how effective they are in stopping fraudulent use by making sure that if there's an unusual pattern of use on a credit card, they detect it in real time and they intervene to suspend the card. And the result is that, you know, of course there's fraudulent use, there is theft, but it's not very much compared with what there could be. That has nothing to do with government programs, and it's all about the private action on the part of the credit card companies. So that's one collection of activities, and then the other is the kind of co-production of public security, where private citizens voluntarily come forward to cooperate with the police and with the courts in order to make sure that the criminals have some chance of being arrested and prosecuted and ultimately convicted. The system absolutely depends on that kind of voluntary cooperation, but does not reward the cooperators in any particular way. So it really often is a charitable act on the part of the private citizen that we depend on in order to have that kind of crime control. And so as a result, it's interesting to look at ways in which we could improve cooperation, make it more effective, and increase the effectiveness of the criminal justice system as a result.
Could you explain how economists in general, and you in particular, approach analyzing the costs and benefits of these different approaches to tackling crime?
You know, we can do cost-benefit analysis in crime control just as we do if we're trying to analyze a project to build a new dam or a road or something. What gets tricky is trying to assign a price to a crime prevented. There are methods of doing that. The method that I certainly favor is called a contingent valuation method. It's also used in environmental economics to evaluate in environmental programs. The method is to ask a representative sample of the public how much they would be willing to pay for a reduction in crime. For example, one study said, how much would you be willing to pay for a 10% reduction in crime in your community? And in particular, would you be willing to vote for a measure that would reduce crime by 10% if it would cost you an extra $50 in your taxes or an extra $100 in your taxes? And so that approach then allows you to, in effect, trace out the demand curve for crime prevention and use that then to figure out what the private benefit is to living in a safer community and feeling more secure in your life. So that method then produces dollar values that we can use as social benefit measures and often are done in that way. On the cost side, we have to pay attention to the costs of the public investment in criminal justice, but also to the private actions, which are often costly. So if a company hires a security guard or installs a closed-circuit television or acquires a new anti-shoplifting system, that obviously is part of the evaluation and has to go on the cost side of the ledger. So we add it all up at the end of the day and we say, is this measure worth it from society's point of view or not?
And how much impact does that kind of analysis play in policymaking around crime fighting in the US?
If I might say so, I think it plays more of a role during hard times than in good times. I think right now there's a very receptive audience in the state legislatures to arguments based on cost and on benefit. When the revenue is flowing during good times, there seems to be much less interest in that, and more of the politics is symbolic and about feel-good actions that people take. But right now, I think the state legislators in the cities are very concerned about economizing in all kinds of ways. And if we can come forward and say, look, you can adopt these measures which will actually pay for themselves and then some, that has a receptive audience.
So looking at the broad range of your research and others' research there, what are the sort of high return responses to crime? You said at the beginning that the prisons are highly expensive and not particularly effective in providing a deterrence. So what are the actual other options that we might really get some high returns from, particularly during tough times?
During tough times, and I hope it carries over. Because often I think that the things that we should do to economize are also things that would be in the public interest for other reasons. That the use of prison is immoral, I mean, to the extent that it's being done in the United States. So. My favorite first answer would be to increase the tax on alcohol. You know, if you want a policy that pays for itself, this is it. And much more, again, in the States than in Britain or the UK, the tax rates on alcohol are low. They have gone down in real value over the last 50 years. It represents a terrific opportunity because states can raise the tax. One of the consequences would be the revenue, but another consequence would be less alcohol abuse, which means less crime. I mean, I think that there's as close a connection as you could ask for in that area. So that would be an example of a very attractive policy. In the criminal justice area, I think what is looking like an extremely attractive policy is coerced abstinence for convicted criminals, many of whom have a drug problem. And so if they are put on a program after release that says every time they abuse drugs, they will be tested and put in jail for a few days, then we can hope to see a reduction in their crime rates because they will stop abusing the drugs. That may not sound plausible, but there has just been a large-scale experiment in Honolulu with this approach, which showed an extraordinarily large effect on both drug abuse and on subsequent crime. The result being that the court, once it was able to establish a credible threat, not of a long prison term in response to failing the drug test, but just a few days, that these guys stopped using drugs. And if they stopped using drugs, they stopped doing crime. It was an equation you could rely on. So that turns out to be quite a different way of doing business for the courts. Usually they allow people who are on parole or probation to fail their drug test time after time with no consequence. And then one time, it happens once too often, and their release is revoked and they're sent back to prison for years. So again, the key here is a high probability, but the severity can be very low. You get the response that way. The net result is actually less prison, less people in prison than you would have otherwise.
What about guns, Philip? I know that's an area that you've done a lot of work on, and Europeans often perceive that American crime has perhaps been particularly influenced by the prevalence of guns, and perhaps the crimes being worse, more violent.
Yeah, it's certainly true that it's not that the U.S. is a particularly violent country compared with Western Europe, but the fact is that our violence is more likely to be lethal. So when there's an assault or a robbery in the U.S., it's much more likely to involve a gun, and if it does, it's more likely to kill somebody. So our murder rates are off the charts, and that's continues to be such a contentious area in the U.S. That there does not seem to be much that can be done except through better police work and police work that's focused on underground gun markets with the hope that then that will discourage people from carrying guns. But in terms of regulations that will keep them from getting the guns in the first place, it seems unlikely. The Supreme Court has recently weighed in on this and so it made it that much more difficult now that all us Americans have a right to keep and bear arms. And so
it's not so much of a cost-benefit thing, but there's sort of issues about people's views on their personal freedom.
Yeah, that's right. That has really carried the day in the U.S. But it is still true that people are reluctant to allow felons and children to carry guns. I mean, we haven't gone quite that far, and so police work directed in that direction can be effective, and I think that remains an active area for a lot of the big city police departments.
Talking about the police departments, what about the kind of work they do? Are they able to use new techniques and the new technology, for example, the internet, to do their work more effectively?
There has been a great increase in the use of technology built into better management practice. And I think William Bratton, who famously was the chief in New York City during the years of the great crime decline there, was one of the innovators in this respect. So he adopted a method called CompStat, which was very quick feedback to his commanders, to his district commanders, about crime problems that were occurring in each of the districts of New York City, that he used to hold them accountable for reducing crime and also to provide guidance to them about how could they solve the problems that were reflected in those crime rates. And so it's hard to believe it, but if you go back to the 1970s, the police were often not held accountable for crime. The police chiefs would say that really it's poverty that causes crime, or, you know, it's racial conflict that causes crime, but it's not, we have nothing to do with it. We come in and clean up the messes afterwards. It wasn't until Bratton came along and said, by God, I am responsible, I'm in charge, my commanders are going to be in charge, and you can hold me accountable for the result, that we began to hear a different rhetoric and a different reality. But I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that they began to have the technological tools that were useful in that respect to get really good crime data in with quick turnaround and engage in this kind of problem-solving activity that they were doing.
You mentioned poverty and racial conflict. How much of crime do you feel is driven by big inequalities in society? And America is a very unequal society, certainly in comparison with continental European countries. Is that a big driver? And does that suggest that you could tackle crime in some ways by social policies, dealing with the bottom end of the income distribution, perhaps with education policies, this kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, I think it is true fundamentally that people who have few legitimate options in our society are vulnerable to the temptations of criminal activity. And so we would like to have children grow up robust and resistant to those temptations, and part of that is going to be to assure them that they really do have a place in legitimate society. So saying, the population we have as it is capable of a very wide range of crime, depending on how we respond to the problem. So it's not, I want to be clear about this. I think the root causes are there, they're relevant, but all they do is determine a potential. The reality of how much crime there actually is depends very much on environmental issues and the issues of the moment. So if you look at what happened during the crack cocaine epidemic in the United States that started in 1985, there were cities that experienced an increase in the homicide rate of a factor of 10. If you look at Washington, D.C. in particular, it became the murder capital of the world, and young black men had 10 times the murder rate by 1993 that they had in 1985. It wasn't any change in poverty or any change in the conditions under which they were living. The change was the systemic effects of the crack cocaine trade and all of the trouble that created. You take the same population and you say, well, they can have a crime rate of X or they can have a crime rate of 10X. It just depends if we're smart enough to be able to get the conditions right. That's the place you start, but it's not the place to finish. I mean, I think that we should continue working on the background.
Final question. What do you see as being the research agenda lying ahead for the economics of crime? It seems to be an area that's growing of interest and growing in appeal around the world.
Yeah, I'm delighted to see that. I've always thought that crime is very important, that it's worthy of the economists' attention, and I'm glad to see that it's finally happening. So I think that we'll see a wide variety of research projects going on. Certainly the economists from the first have been interested in the question of deterrence. That looks like a kind of a form of a price, a threat of punishment, and trying to understand how that works. And so economists felt comfortable in talking about that and researching it. And that will continue to be true. I think there's a lot of interest in these issues about social policy and root causes. I hope I can interest my fellow economists in this question about private action and how that's going to work. I think that there is more about that, about situational crime prevention, and also about how people cooperate or don't cooperate with the criminal justice system. But, you know, the mystery to me has always been the areas that the economists have not chosen to look at so far, which seem like, in many ways, the place that would be most natural for them. Like organized crime, like white-collar crime, like money laundering, you know, like all of the activities that are very close to the commercial life of the country have a criminal side to them. Or why aren't the economic development experts working on crime in the economic development context? I am as confident as I can be that that is an enormous drag on economic development in many countries. So those are areas I think that smart young graduate students should look to and think about getting involved in. There's a lot of work to be done, and it's important work.
Philip Cook, thank you very much.
My pleasure.